I'm Sam Litzinger with Dr. Gary Weitzman of the San Diego Humane Society. Do you have a question for Dr. Gary? Good. 1-877-610-3647 is our telephone number. Or you could visit our Facebook page or our website, WAMUAnimalHouse.org. Let's take a telephone call from Rajiv, who's calling us from Woodbridge, Virginia. Rajiv, glad to have you with us in the Animal House. Question for Dr. Gary?
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Sam and Dr. Gary.
Of course.
I have a 10-year-old beautiful golden retriever dog, and we are having a little trouble with lumps with him.
Of course, okay.
So basically what's happening is that he has a lump on his shoulder kind of thing, you know, which has been there for probably for maybe 2 years or 3 years. And we have been going to the vet at least once every 6 months or a year, and he does a little, like a needle aspiration thingy where he takes out little cells, looks at them,
right,
and it's fatty. Now, Recently what has happened is that we have noticed two more. The big lump, which we are worried about, is probably around half of a tennis ball.
Okay.
So the problem is that the vet says that this lump this time, you know, every time he used to do the aspiration, he used to say, just fat, don't worry about it. But this year he says that now he cannot take anything out and he doesn't know what it is and he wants us to get it excised and maybe that. Now we are really worried about it because, you know, we had one of our friends who had the same kind of trouble with his dog, and his dog had the lump taken out, and within 3 weeks he died after that because the cancer spread or something like that. And we're worried about what to do. And we want your opinion, if you can, please.
The question is, how do you know whether or not a lump needs to be removed, Gary? How do you decide that as a veterinarian?
Well, Rajiv, first of all, I mean, your relationship with your own vet is the most critical one here, because that's the conversation to have with him or her. Of course, that doesn't need to be said. But you're right. First of all, old dogs get lumps. They do. They're just a lump factory. And thank heavens, the majority of those lumps are absolutely benign consequences of getting older. Some dogs even start with lipomas or fatty tumors, you know, quite a young age. Now, the one that you just described, that your vet wasn't sure what it was, that's the one where you need to do, I think you do need to listen to him and do something about that one. Because if he doesn't know what it is, it may be your opportunity, one, to get rid of it altogether, or two, to at least biopsy it and be able to put your mind at ease that it's nothing to worry about. A skin mass generally does not lead to a malignancy. I mean, sure, we do see mast cell tumors. We do see some melanomas, but they're thankfully more rare. And for those, we can generally, you know, see that on an aspirate. You can certainly see a mast cell tumor. So I don't think I'd worry that by messing with this thing, it's going to cause a spread of the, you know, of a cancer. I think really what you want is the information. So I would take it as an opportunity, talk to your vet, of course, but take it as an opportunity to maybe get your pup's teeth cleaned and maybe just get this thing biopsied and maybe even preferably get it removed if it's possible to do that. So, but okay. I think, you know, I do agree with your vet. I think it's, if he can't tell what it is, there's other ways to find out. So the biopsy is the way to go.
All right. Thank you very much, both of you.
Our telephone number is 1-877-610-3647. Our website is WAMUAnimalHouse.org. Let's take a telephone call from Amy, who's calling us from Chattanooga, Tennessee. Amy, glad to have you with us in the Animal House. Question for Dr. Gary?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Gary. I am having a very odious problem with my cat. This started a few months ago.
Okay.
Yes, and basically what's happened is just suddenly out of the blue, it's gone from normal cat, you know, going to the bathroom, to now whenever she goes to the bathroom, every so often it is so incredibly horribly smelly that we literally have to evacuate our house.
Dear.
And the cat, so it's odious and odiferous.
Yes, both of those things. And the cat can't be happy. What is the cat's name, by the way, Amy?
Her name is Samantha. She's lived with us for about 13 years come this year. And we don't feed her human food at all.
Okay.
It totally offends her as well. You can tell it's coming whenever she rockets right out of the bathroom or we have the litter box.
Aw,
poor baby.
Okay. Is she constipated at all?
Well, not that I can tell. I mean, it's...
Okay.
The amount coming, she's having movements, but the amount coming out may not be as much as it used to be.
Couple questions for you. Food hasn't changed, right?
No. Well, about 4 months ago, I did start adding a wet food just because if I think of her age, she's lost a bit of weight.
Good idea. We do like wet food for cats.
And did the problem occur after you started adding the wet food or before?
About 3 months after it started.
Okay,
and
hard
I
to really pin it on that. Okay.
Too, as far as that goes, we can't feed her certain things because she will get sick from them.
Okay. Okay, so food's been pretty stable. There's no real other problems you can see, neither constipation or its best friend, the opposite, isn't happening. She's not vomiting too much or anything like that, right?
No, just maybe okay. Once a month, and she likes to gorge, so.
Okay, the normal cat, you know, vomiting one every now and then. Okay, well, first of all, of course, tell this to your vet. So that she can have a checkup. And every animal should have a checkup once a year anyway. So that said, there's a couple things. You know, she is, I think you said, what, 12, 13 years old. So she's getting into her, you know, senior years. Let's plan on her living to be 30, but still. So metabolisms do change, and therefore she could have some issues with what she's, you know, producing that it doesn't smell great. But, you know, what you're describing, the kind of smell that can make someone want to move to another state is very much in cats like what I think about when I remember the cats used to come to me that were obstipated, meaning that they're just really pathologically constipated and haven't gone to the bathroom for a while. And then what comes out of there just makes you want to find a different profession.
Right.
And many was probably the thought I had. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that might – so I wonder if this girl is more – constipated or things are firmer than they ought to be. So here's a suggestion for you to try. I love canned pumpkin for cats. It's just a great source of soluble fiber. It's a really good thing to do if they'll eat it, and that's the big if, to get things running normally. And it can really help with constipation. And it can help even if there isn't constipation, just good soluble fiber. So maybe add a tablespoon of, well, start with a teaspoon, of unsweetened canned pumpkin to her food, to her wet food. Lots of good liquid in there as well, if she'll eat it. And a lot of them do. So I would try that really benign way to see if that makes a difference, and then go up a little bit. And then you're going to have to be the inspector general of the litter box to make sure that she's producing what, you know, you want. Dial it back if it's too loose, that kind of thing. If she hates it and thinks that you're the worst thing in the world to be poisoning her with this horrible squash-like vegetable, then you can just use Lactitone or Petromalt and get her maybe a teaspoon of that a day to really help with the hairballs, help with, you know, whatever constipation, or just to get things running, you know, properly. That's not a bad thing to do. You can either mix that in food in the flavor that she likes because it comes in like five flavors, or just put it in her mouth or wipe it in her lip if she doesn't mind that. But I would start with the pumpkin and see if that changes things.
All right, Amy?
Sounds great, and I will do.
Okay.
Say hi to
All
Samantha
good luck.
For us.
Thank you.
Sam. Thank you very much, Amy. We have an email from a caller who wants to find a sugar glider rescue organization. Her daughter is going to college, and they don't want to give them up to just anyone. Okay, now that caught my attention because a sugar glider, I asked myself immediately. And then I thought, well, I better ask somebody who knows about these sorts of things better than I do, which is A, Gary, and B, Dr. Scott Stahl, who's an exotic animal veterinarian.
I love having Dr. Scott come in on this.
Dr. Stahl, glad to have you back with us in the Animal House.
Sam, thanks so much, and Dr. Gary as well. I appreciate the opportunity to help out.
What's a sugar glider?
So sugar gliders are, these are one of the animals that we consider an exotic pet, and they're a nocturnal species, arboreal as well, that come from Australia and New Guinea. And they're uniquely marsupials, so they have this little pouch, of course, that the baby spends a great deal of time in during the maturation process. And again, they're a rainforest, kind of an exotic animal. Of course, they're captive bred now for the pet trade. And other interesting things about them is that they're sort of a social animal. They live in smaller groups, usually between, you know, six, up to as low as six to up to a dozen animals. And then, of course, they get their name, the glider, because they have sort of this membrane, like these wing-like, sort of like a bat. You know, they have these extra skin flaps like a flying squirrel attached to their fifth digit of their little hand that then attaches down near the ankle. And when they jump, they sort of spread those little arms out and they can glide, if you will.
Wow.
And then the sugar concept comes from, just the very unique diet that these guys eat, you know, back in Australia and New Guinea. They primarily feed on the gum and sap of the eucalyptus trees that they live in during the winter months when insects and bugs are more difficult to find. And then in the spring and summer and fall, they are primarily insectivorous. So they sort of do a sugar insect bug based diet is kind of what they eat in the wild.
And sounds so wonderful.
One of the more difficult things about them is trying to, you know, simulate that type of environment, you know, that niche of habitat that they have in captivity. And this is where we sometimes run into trouble with some of the exotic animals.
Well, I should ask you, because before I ask you about a possible rescue organization here, should we even have sugar gliders in the United States in our homes?
We could probably spend a couple of hours on that discussion, but it's a great question. I do think they can. We see them quite a lot in our practice. You know, our practice is exclusively an exotic animal practice, and we do see these guys, and they have become more and more popular. And I think in the right hands, with people educating themselves about the proper care and doing a good job with their husbandry and feeding them correctly and doing a good job of socialization, I think they can make good pets. And luckily, we're not importing these animals. They're not coming from the wild. So they are adapted to the captive environment in that they're born into captivity. But I think the idea is, you have to do your research, and you need to look for help and make sure that you're doing the right thing with the animal. And oftentimes, of course, you know how things happen. People will buy them first and then research later. And if possible, it's best to, you know, before you jump off that bridge, to investigate, you know, what the needs of the animal are going to be.
Yeah. Do you know of any sugar glider rescue organizations then?
There are a few, actually. One of them is called SugiSavers.org.
Okay, SugiSavers.org.
SugiSavers.
All right.
So SugiSavers.org, and that's a national sugar glider rescue group, and so they have a very nice, helpful web page. And then SugarGliderHelp.com. That's a little easier to follow. Mm-hmm. SugarGliderHelp.com, and that is a local sugar glider rescue group. And then there is PetFinder.com. I think they can help sometimes with things like this. And then sometimes what we typically recommend for some of these exotic pets is hopefully the owner has been maybe already working with an exotic animal veterinarian. And what we sometimes suggest our clients to do is to, you know, put a flyer up at their exotic animal veterinary office that says free to the right home and offer, you know, the supplies and caging and the animal to the right person. Usually people that are already coming into a veterinary hospital hopefully are already responsible and have an understanding about the animals. And so sometimes that ends up being a good match.
And just vet them even more before you would give them up on that. Gary, have you ever run into
Yes, and actually I want to echo what Dr. Scott said. You know, we see them, unfortunately, as relinquishments to shelters in a lot of cases, sometimes in neglect situations. And I think that's actually it. I think Scott just said it really well, that, you know, want people to know what they're getting into before they get an exotic animal. So the only thing I caution out there is, you know, there's plenty of dogs and cats, like 3 million we need to get into homes. So I think we'd all agree these creatures need to stay where they belong, which is in the arboreal forests of, you know, New Guinea and Australia,
right,
and preferably not our homes. But yeah, at least we're not importing them. If you do get one of these, make sure you get that animal treated and monitored by an exotics vet somewhere near you, someone with specialty in these creatures, because you want to give them the best life possible.
Yeah.
Dr. Scott Stahl, thank you very much for that advice, and we'll point Jay, our emailer, in the right direction on this. Much appreciated.
Okay, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Dr. Gary.
Sure, Sam. Here's a confession. I hate leaving my pets. It's not that I'm chained to my house. It's just that they're really part of me, and I don't like being away from them any more than they like being away from me. There's nothing wrong with that. The pathology comes when we can never be separated from them. That's not good for anyone. As a matter of fact, that's the basis for separation anxiety. What we want is to make our animals well-behaved and confident, so if you're dealing with a dog who'd rather remodel your living room while you're gone than wait for your slippers and you to get back, it's time for some independence training. Look for your closest CPDT-designated trainer to help with this. Your woodwork and your dog will be grateful. For The Animal House, this is Dr. Gary Weitzman.
This edition of The Animal House is near completion. First, though, we have the answer to our Animal of the Day quiz. Earlier, we asked if you knew the names of the two tuna species that are considered endangered. The answer? The southern bluefin and the Atlantic bluefin. By the way, the Pacific bluefin tuna is a species of least concern. That's according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Special thanks to Dr. Gary Weitzman for his work. And thanks to you for joining us in the Animal House. So long.